Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is David Christian. Today, he will be continuing his series on art. Art is a Christian activity. Let's listen in.
My name is David Christian. To my left is Richard Evans, and the title of this session is Art as a Christian Activity. This is part two of a four-session series that Richard and I are doing during the course of this week. Part one was yesterday. How many people were not here last night when we began? Okay. I think, therefore, it would be helpful to do a little bit of review of things that we covered yesterday, because some things that I talk about today are going to build on that. Before I do that, though, I'd like to just hold up in front of you a number of books that I am going to be referring to today. And I know that Richard will refer to at least one of them later in the week. And that one is Walking on Water by Madeline L'Engle. It's for sale in the bookstore, Reflections on Faith and Art. I'm also going to be referring today to a small book that I got at the Holden bookstore some years ago called Art Needs No Justification by H.R. Rookmacher, which is a very helpful little book, but it unfortunately is out of print. I asked the bookstore to try and get a hold of it, and they told me it was out of print, but I show it to you anyway. I'm also going to be referring some to a book called Art in Action by Nicholas Wolterstorff, which is helpful. It's probably a little less accessible than this, which is one reason that we chose this one as the bookstore entry. And I'll be reading one brief paragraph from Chaim Potok's wonderful book, My Name is Asher Lev, that I highly commend to you. Yesterday, at the beginning of our session, we spent a little bit of time listening to, I asked people to tell me of events or activities in their life when they felt that they were an artist, when they did something creative, and we talked about that briefly. Among those activities mentioned were setting a table, when company was coming, preparing to be the gracious host. One member of the community talked about going up to the third level and piling up rocks, leaving his mark that way, forming a little cairn. That was a significant event for him. We had a woman that talked, she remembered after the birth of her two daughters that she spent time, partly I think to keep her sanity and partly in response to the event, doing a lot of needlework. And those incidents, were particularly, those in particular were significant to me as I was listening to the responses, because they lined up with some thoughts by a woman named Ellen Dissanayake, who wrote a book called Homo Aestheticus. Dissanayake is an anthropologist who makes a case that there might be a biological necessity for art in the human species. She defines art as the activity of making important things special. She suggests that this activity may have in fact contributed to the survival of our species, and therefore suggests that we could be called Homo sapiens, Homo aestheticus, aesthetic beings, as well as Homo sapiens, or any one of the other possibilities that people have proposed. At the end of her book, she comes to three conclusions. Number one, that art is a universal human need that modern society, to the large part, denies. Number two, that art is both more variable and more simple than most modern art theorists allow. And number three, that the activity of making things one cares about special is fundamental and deserves to be acknowledged, encouraged, and developed. We recognize that her understanding or sense of art is not the way that we commonly think of art in our culture. So I gave about a 2.5 minute overview of Western art. We talked about the increased significance of the individual artist. We talked about the divorce of art from the functions that helped bind it to important events in the community. And we had some conversation about the complicating impact of the market. I'd like to read a brief several paragraphs that came out of the newspaper, the little newsletter published by the Port Angeles Symphony Orchestra. We have a wonderful community orchestra, for the most part volunteer, and this occurred, I think, in the March issue. The president of a large California managed care company was also chairman of the board of his community symphony orchestra. Finding he could not go to one of the concerts, he gave his tickets to the company's director of health cost containment. The next morning, he asked the director how he enjoyed the performance. Instead of usual polite remarks, the director handed him a memorandum which read as follows. The undersigned submits the following comments and recommendations relative to the performance of Schubert's unfinished symphony as observed under actual working conditions. A. The attendance of the orchestra conductor is unnecessary for public performances. The orchestra has obviously practiced and has the prior authorization from the conductor to play the symphony at a predetermined level of quality. Considerable money could be saved by merely having the conductor critique the orchestra's performance during a retrospective peer review meeting. B. For considerable periods, the four oboe players had nothing to do. Their numbers should be reduced and their work spread over the whole orchestra, thus eliminating peaks and valleys of activity. C. All 12 violins were playing identical notes with identical motions. This is unnecessary duplication. The staff of this section should be drastically cut with consequent savings. If a larger volume of sound is required, this could be obtained through electronic amplification, which has reached very high levels of reproductive quality. D. Much effort was expended playing 16th notes or semiquavers. This seems an excessive refinement, as most of the listeners are unable to distinguish such rapid playing. It is recommended that all notes be rounded up to the nearest eighth. If this is done, it would be possible to use trainees and lower grade operators with no loss of quality. E. No useful purpose would appear to be served by repeating the horns, repeating with horns the same passage that has already been handled by the strings. If such redundant passages were eliminated, as determined by the Utilization Review Committee, the concert could have been reduced from 2 hours to 20 minutes, with greater savings in salaries and overhead. In fact, if Schubert had attended to these matters on a cost containment basis, he probably would have been able to finish his symphony.
Oh, dear.
I put that in there in part for the humor, but in part because the idea behind it, I think it is significant that there are any number of forces that make us question the worth and the value and the place of art, and that's what has really led to this series of sessions. I'd like to focus today on the third conclusion that Ellen Dysniacki suggested at the end of her book, and that is that the activity of making things one cares about special is fundamental and deserves to be acknowledged, encouraged, and developed. One thing that didn't come up in our, I think, fairly lively discussion after the session yesterday was that when Dysniacki was looking at pre-modern cultures, she was talking about much smaller and more defined communities than most of us are aware of being part of today. So in that sense, our task making broad generalizations about art is a little more difficult and perhaps a little bit unfair. She was talking about a much smaller audience. It's difficult to consider that broad question. I think the question becomes a little more easy, a little more manageable, if we can narrow down the community and not consider the world at large. And being a Christian, it makes some sense to consider the Christian community as the sort of defining context for this discussion. This is interesting and difficult for me because throughout my art career, going to school, I did this at the University of Minnesota, both undergraduate and graduate degrees. Issues of faith certainly were not part of the curriculum, were not part of the discussion. And while connections between the rest of my life and faith issues have always been important to me, I was not very conscious of making those decisions, those connections, when I was in art school. This is something that I've really been struggling with and working with more in the last couple years. And I think that's one of the reasons that I was interested in doing these sessions, was to help motivate myself to think through some of these things and also to get other people's input and perspectives on that. So looking back again at Dissanayake's question or conclusion that the activity of making important things special is fundamental and deserves to be acknowledged, encouraged, and developed, what I'd like to do is turn that question around, maybe pull it apart, and try and answer it or think about it from a theological perspective. That might involve asking questions like, can we say that creativity or art is part of our created nature? We could ask questions like, what biblical attitudes of art do we know about? Where in the Bible do we know that art exists? And does the Bible take a stance that the art is good or bad? Or we could ask historically, how has the church acknowledged, encouraged, and developed the activity of making art? And we could ask, what do contemporary artists and theologians interested in the arts say about all of these other questions? Being a Lutheran, I look first to the Bible. Look for references to the arts in the Bible. And I wish I had handed some of these out sooner. Yeah, we don't need a whole lot, but
share them?
Yeah, share them.
We have enough.
And I'd like to just spend a little time looking up some biblical references to the arts, which in some cases I had not been aware of before I set out to organize these sessions, and just see the different attitudes towards the arts that are expressed there. Let's look at Numbers 21, verse 8. Would somebody want to read verse 8 and 9 for me? Numbers 21, verse 8 and 9.
And the Lord said to Moses, make a poisonous serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten shall look at it and live. So Moses made a serpent of bronze and put it upon a pole, and whenever a serpent bit someone, that person would look at the serpent of bronze and live.
So what do we have here? We have a sculpture that is useful to the community. Let's look at Exodus 32.
Which verse is
here? Oh, let's have somebody read Well, let's keep it somewhat short. Let's just read 7 to 10. Who would read 7 to 10?
The Lord said to Moses, go down at once. Your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have acted perversely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I commanded them. They have cast for themselves an image of a calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. The Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, that's who they are. Now let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. And of you I will make a great nation.
So here we have the contrast, an example of art, of sculpture being looked at in a negative light for the negative impact it has on the community. On the same page, in most cases, let's look at Exodus 31. Let's see. 31:1-11. Who'd read that? 31:1-11.
The Lord spoke to Moses. See, I have called by name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with divine spirit, with ability, intelligence, and knowledge in every kind of craft, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, in cutting stones for setting, and in carving wood, in every kind of craft. Moreover, I have appointed with him Aholiab, son of Ashishamet, of the tribe of Dan, and I have given skill to all that skill, so that they may all that I have commanded, the tent of meeting, and the ark of the covenant, and the mercy seat that is on it, and all the furnishings of the tent, the table and its utensils, and the pure lampstone stand with all its utensils, and the altar of incense, and the altar of burnt offering with all its utensils, and the basin with its stand, and the finely worked vestments, the holy vestments for the priest Aaron, and the vestments of his sons for service as priests, and the anointing oil and the fragrant incense for the holy place. They shall do just as I have commanded you.
Okay, so clearly again, we have art being instituted by God. Let's turn to Hosea chapter 8, verse 4. Hosea chapter 8, verse 4, just one verse. Would somebody read that, please? Page 863 in the red ones, yeah.
They made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but without my knowledge. With their silver and gold, they made idols for their own destruction.
I have a list of more texts that we could go back and forth with, but I think the point is fairly clear that if we look in the Bible, we can find proof texts or examples where art is taken seriously and upheld, or we can find examples where art is taken seriously for its negative consequences to the community. And I don't find it particularly helpful to kind of weigh these back and forth, but I think what is significant to note throughout is that there are instances in the Bible where art is taken seriously. If I were to ask, how many of those four passages were familiar to all of you? Most of them? All of them? I mean, there were a couple new ones in there for me. Certainly the bronze serpent, you know, came to mind easily, but the Exodus 31, you know, was newer to me. So I think that this topic of biblical references to the arts are not something that are part of our common conversation. If I were to ask, instead of instances within the Bible where we have art talked about, if I were instead to ask, give me one obvious example of creative activity, what would be the common
creation?
Right. Yes?
It's a very interesting thing in the new RSV. The Lutherans, Roman Catholics, and Episcopalians always have this big thing about the numbering of our commandments being different from, say, the Baptists, which always have, you shall make no graven image. But the new translation says, you shall not make for yourself an idol. Hmm. So, I mean, there's this very interesting evolution of the translation, which helps us a little. We just leave it out. Or subsume it under the first one.
The creation story is used not infrequently to begin talk about creative activity. And it's a story that I have found useful in some of my thinking about justifying that which I do. It struck me at one point in reading through the creation story, when we get to the creation of Adam and Eve and discover that they were created in God's image, that at that point, God's image is what? Only that of Creator. All the other attributes that we have of God are things that come later on in the Bible. So at that point, that is one of the prime characteristics of God, and I think can be a useful starting point for thinking about art or creativity as part of our created being.
David, one thing just to add to complications, in 2 Kings 18:4, they break, and they clean the temple out, they break the bronze serpent in pieces.
Oh, yeah.
In that temple cleansing. Kind of an interesting...
Yeah, for somebody more scholarly than I think it would be interesting to go through and find all the references and see how they may line up with different sources for the books, too, to see books that came more out of the priestly tradition, if they had maybe one attitude toward the arts. And, I haven't got a clue how to begin going about that, but when you retire, that's another one. When you get done... Is it Benjamin that you're going to...
Yeah.
Yes, when you get done with Benjamin, you can work on this one. Great.
Well, okay. I'm sure that the iconoclasts use that.
Well, my guess is that it has to do with all of the art objects that represent the varying religions that are part of the temple, yeah, and that gets cleansed both under Hezekiah and under Josiah.
Well, I have a manuscript that I said, why didn't God didn't make the world gray, except when it's foggy in Seattle. The point is, and David is making a very strong point, look what the Creator did. And see all the variety and the options and things that we have, and then go down to humankind. And I think there's a pretty strong argument there for what we should be doing or should enjoy doing.
Kind of to follow up on that and follow up on what I was just talking about with using the story of creation as a beginning point, that begs the question of how do we think of God as creator? Do we think of God as one who snaps fingers and things suddenly come into being? My experience being a creative artist is that that's not how things are created. One gets much more involved. One gets messy. One gets dirty. One has false starts. One makes mistakes. And I have found that interesting, to kind of turn that back and use that to help shape my image of God, to think not of God as the benevolent, white-haired old man on the Sistine Chapel reaching out and just barely touching creation with a fingertip, that's kind of a distanced sense, but rather much more involved, getting messy, because that is my has been my experience. Madeline L'Engle has a wonderful image of the way creativity happens, and it might be nice to apply that to God the Creator and to consider God's continuing involvement in creation. And her image is that of a French cook who on the stove has three or four pots constantly bubbling, and that, you know, when cutting up some meat, you have some meat scraps and you throw some into that pot, but you only put the beef in here and you put the chicken in here and some vegetables in here. And when you need to have something done, you look whichever one is farthest along. So you're always tinkering, and then you bring things to completion and you go back and tinker more with others. Anyway, having gotten somewhere but not real far with looking directly to the Bible for sources that might suggest that art or creativity is part of our created being, I look to three more contemporary writers who approach the issue, and I mentioned them a little bit earlier. I would just like to share with you some of the ideas that the three of them talk about. All three of them, I think, address the notion that art is part of our created being by talking about the whole idea of wholeness. That art is one way that we come to completion, that we can come to completion. Certainly that is a bigger part of some of us than of others. But that art can also be a way to help all of creation come to completion. Ruckmacher in Art Needs No Justification begins actually in this book by a quick overview of Western art history, much like what I gave you yesterday, and comes to some very similar conclusions about how art is divorced from its function, and finds that in the contemporary world, art therefore finds itself in the position of having to justify its place quite often. He quite simply feels that art is justified simply by being a God-given possibility. It's part of the whole package of human activity, and that alone is enough to affirm its worth. He also suggests that art for the Christian is part of our everyday life, and I love one of the images he uses at this point. He is cautious about stating how overtly Christian art needs to be Christian. Do we have to paint pictures of Jesus on the walls of diving shops like we do in Port Angeles? That's a little aside story. People from Port Angeles know, there's a dive shop in Port Angeles, and one of the owners of that shop was out doing some diving in the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and somebody got mixed up with the currents, reading the currents, and two divers went down, and the boat was expecting them to float this way, and when they came up an hour later, they had floated that way, and the boat waited around for a long, long time, and finally gave them up for lost and continued back to Port Angeles. And these two men floated on the Straits of Juan de Fuca and actually floated towards Port Angeles and were picked up by a fishing boat the next morning, I think. And in response to that, one of the fellows has painted on the side of the dive shop, "Thank you, Jesus," with this kind of gruesome picture of Jesus with the crown of thorns carrying the cross and John 3:16 underneath it. Does Christian art need to be that overt, that didactic? Ruckmacher suggests that it doesn't. He suggests that Christian art ought to be more like plumbing than like preaching, in the sense that it falls into the background. It's not something that we always think about, but it's always there, and it's something that we deeply depend on.
Preaching ought to be that way too.
Could be. Could be. Art in the, he thinks of art in the sense that things that are done must be done with care, that when we make things, that we pay attention to details. We ought to show the same care in the things that we do as the Creator showed in setting out for us the store of materials to work with. Madeline L'Engle in Walking on Water also talks about creativity as part of our created being. She does so in here. This is not a very systematic treatment of the subject. It tends to be a more shotgun approach, a series of reflections, which makes it very accessible and enjoyable reading. She repeatedly talks about creativity as becoming, as part of becoming whole, and talks about it in terms of the creativity evidenced in childhood. She suggests the following statistics, that in our society at the age of 5, 90% of the population measures high creativity. By the age of 7, that figure has dropped to 10%, and the percentage of adults with high creativity is down to 2%. She says, our creativity is destroyed not through the use of outside force, but through criticism and innuendo. When I read that, it reminded me of this very poignant section in My Name is Asher Lev that I'd like to just read a few paragraphs for you. This is Asher and his father. Asher at this point is a young boy. He, his father, said to me once, gazing at one of my drawings, "You have nothing better to do with your time, Asher? Your grandfather would not have liked you to waste so much time with foolishness." "It is a drawing, Papa." "I see what it is." "A drawing is not foolishness, Papa." He looked at me in surprise, but he said nothing. I was almost 5 at the time. He was indifferent to my drawing. He thought it was something children did when they were very young and then outgrew. But I continued to draw him away anyway. I continued to draw him anyway. Though after a while, I stopped showing him the drawings. I think it's interesting. I don't think I'm fishing too far to make a connection between the creativity that perhaps exists in children and to see some correlation with Dissanayake's studies of pre-modern cultures who don't have as sophisticated, as complicated a culture that probably teaches them that creativity is not as useful, functional, that those cultures are perhaps able to be playful in a way that we are not, and ironically are able to be more whole perhaps than we are. L'Engle also suggests that the purpose of the work, be it story or music or painting, is to further the coming of the kingdom, to make us aware of our status as children of God, and to turn our feet towards home. I like that image of turning our feet towards home. She uses the image of the prodigal son, who when he is a swineherder suddenly realizes that he is no longer complete and that he must turn his feet towards home and be all of what he is. She suggests that art, that creativity, is something that we ought also use to turn our feet towards home, to be more whole and more complete.
When we think of the creativity of children and how it gets beat out of them, then we go to the verse, "Except you become as a little child, you shall not enter the kingdom of God." I know that I have a composer on my staff that he's still a child. He's a year older than I am. Sometimes we think the eccentricities of artists, we just think they're weird and not with the society. But they're trying to keep their child-likeness so they can be creative. And it's very interesting what she says, what David has told us about keeping that child to be creative. And it's, my wife is a private piano teacher, and she's so careful when a youngster brings in a piece that they've created. You know, like, it's not like Beethoven. Well, you don't. Of course, he's not Beethoven. Or she's not Beethoven. She's Susie. And this is Susie, this era. And to encourage it rather than, as you say, critique it.
I think in a way the society is doing the right thing when it tells people to not be creative, because this society can't stand much creativity. There's a book that I use, and I'll talk about some next week, when we talk about schooling, that talks about educating for stupidity. It says essentially that's what the school system is supposed to do, because we have a bunch of bright, curious people, because they'd ask a lot of questions about the system, and it wouldn't be very healthy. And I think this happens with creativity, too.
Another reason why artists are sometimes portrayed as cranky, because we're having to swim up against the system. We're swimming upstream and hanging on, because we know it's part of being a child of God.
I mean, I think artists are signs of what could be if people were more fully human.
Get him up here.
Sure. And I think that for that reason, the society keeps trying to marginalize artists.
I, being a proud father of two boys, both of whom like to draw, I could probably fill the next hour with little proud father stories about little things. But since we've kind of been on this, I'll just share one instance that kind of blew me away. Creativity in the sense of making connections, seeing a metaphor. I mean, I never would have thought of that. This was Thomas when he was 5. It was over a year ago. He and I were just driving through Port Angeles, and there was a house on 8th Street that had a stucco front. It didn't have a pitched roof like this. It must have had a flat roof. The front facade goes like this, with a semicircle above the front doorway, and the paint was peeling above the semicircle. And Thomas noticed it, and as we were coming back, he wanted me to look at something on that house and look at the paint that was peeling, and he said, look there where the paint is peeling on the forehead of that house. And I thought that was just a marvelous connection, and that sort of metaphorical thinking, it just blew me away that a 5-year-old could think that way, because how many of us as adults are making those sorts of obscure connections? And I hope he keeps it up. Anyway, I want to allow plenty of time for discussion, so I'll just move on quickly to a few thoughts from Nicholas Wolterstorff in Art in Action. Wolterstorff also, this is a far more systematic, thorough treatment of the subject that we're talking about today. So I would commend it to you if that's your inclination. One of the ways that he approaches it is also by going back to the creation story, but he focuses not so much on the idea I brought up earlier about being created in the image of God and that sort of creative activity, but he focuses on the physicality of creation, as is evidenced by the creation story, that God the Creator repeatedly looks at what is there and says it is good. Wolterstorff suggests that then opens up all of creation around us as a kind of a vast storehouse of materials to tinker with, to move around and play with. Those of you that, I know a few of you anyway, were on an art tour with me last week, and I think I'm doing it again on Thursday. But I'll give you a little preview of one of the pieces now. As you go into the dining hall, on the east end of the dining hall, down below there is a collage of a number of found objects that was done probably in the late 60s?
Yes.
By 69, by Reinhold Marxhausen. And for me, that's a great example of one who had a kind of playful attitude of looking at the physicality of creation and picking up core samples from the mine and rusty steel bits from drilling holes into the mountain, and putting those together and simply playing with the shapes and textures and getting delight out of that. So Walter Storff spends a fair amount of time talking about that, that affirmation of the physicality of creation, which I think is useful in that the church often has a sort of dualism that suggests that spiritual things are more important than physical things. He strikes out very strongly against that and says that the physicality of something is never enough to assign it lower value simply because it has that sort of physical nature. You look like
that. Well, that's one of the big issues of our time. And this is why some of us feel that Plato, emphasizing what's out there, the spirit, has done damage to the material creation in the way that we think about our world. And I know creationist spirituality and some different church groups have a more important view of matter. Matter is more important, is what I'm trying to say. And we have to be very, very careful here in looking at the created things. Actually, I think Plato was afraid of creativity, just like Dr. Farrell said that our culture is, that sometimes it gets beyond. Engel says, you know, the dictators hate the writers and the artists and the people that are always thinking and trying to get out there beyond the system, the tight system.
There's a whole strain in C.S. Lewis's writing in which he understands spiritual not to mean less matter, but in fact to mean more matter, thicker, harder to get to. The whole scene in The Great Divorce is how tough it is to walk in this place, which is quite obviously heaven. It's too hard for us. And to me, that was a really interesting idea, that spirits aren't like gases. They're like thicker and more material than we're used to.
It was also interesting to me that, as I mentioned earlier, that whereas Madeleine L'Engle had that image of turning one's feet towards home, that sense of moving towards the fullness of the kingdom, that Walter Storff kind of deals with that same notion in terms of art, suggesting that art can be a way of anticipating and maybe even hastening the shalom that awaits us. A shalom is a peace that not only is the absence of hostility, but also includes that whole sense of enjoyment that affirms the notion of a bodily resurrection, of that sort of anticipation, looking forward to a physical wholeness of the kingdom of God. I think I'm going to stop with those three. And at this point yesterday, we had some lively questions that arose. I have some questions that I could present to you if we need a little spurring. But based on the ideas that I've suggested from some of my own thinking and perhaps more from the writers that I've talked about, do we have comments or questions or concerns, reactions? Yes.
Just another writer to add to your list. I've only started reading one of these. You mentioned, so I'm not sure quite how it compares, but it sounds very similar, a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. It's a much more universalist approach, not distinctly Christian, but very clear in her message of importance of creativity and really the obligation to express our creativity. And then she's very systematic in how to help those of us who have shut that part of ourselves off.
She sets up a program that you can follow
right
when you, if you think you're not creative, you can...
A little bit of structure, it's not very harsh.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
For those of us who have trouble staying focused, I found it very helpful.
And I know that that book has been in the bookstore here. And I think it was last week. I don't know that it still is around. It was not one that we requested be here, but... that is a good one. The Artist's Way. Julia Cameron?
Cameron?
Yeah.
She's a screenwriter, and it grew out of her teaching classes for people who were experiencing writer's block.
Mm-hmm.
But it's I think any whatever someone's need of expression is, you'd find it supportive.
What's
the
last name?
Cameron.
C-A-M-E-R-O-N? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The play on words when Richard said something about Plato. I thought, what in the world could be wrong with Plato?
I love it.
I think one of the interesting things about C.S. Lewis is that he actually is a kind of Neoplatonic thinker, and usually it's very destructive in the arts, but in Lewis's case, He has done some reversals and comes off a more positive. But
well, fortunately, he puts most of his effort into his writings.
Yeah.
He has just a very short article of thank goodness, I think.
Yeah.
But he doesn't say much about the arts as far as reflective.
Yeah.
He does the writing, does the novel and things like that. But what he has written is not too bad. I've revisited it and I give him a little more credit. But fortunately, he's more practitioner.
Mm-hmm. I'm still struggling with the question I asked yesterday. The function of art is, sort of what most people immediately think about art as being beautiful, albeit their interpretation is wide, and the function of art as being critical of society. And raised... Or somebody talked about the artist being dangerous. Remember the guy that was just killed in Nigeria,
mm-hmm.
And that was the dramatist that was killed.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are lots of times when they protest. I mean, even Beethoven redesigned the dedication on Symphony Number 3 from We Thank Napoleon to a Great Man. I do a unit on Guernica, Picasso's Guernica, for protest. I mean, he got really busy and they get it done in about 6 weeks and had an exhibition for the Nazis' bombing of the town of Guernica in 1937. Other people say the artists are ahead of their time and we don't like what they're telling us about the future sometimes.
But I mean, I'm thinking that the visual arts and the verbal arts
mm-hmm.
Somehow or other have the advantage of being more specific in say, living and presenting an image mm-hmm. that evokes in others who see or hear what they're getting at. Now, as you as a musician, do you do that by...
Well, Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima by Penderecki sounds pretty much like the sound a bomb makes when it's dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes the pitches and he increases the intensity and goes up and goes down. It's extremely realistic. It's very subtle, and a lot of the things musicians do. We have this problem, we're going to be a little bitchy here about grammar, that we should be doing in the public schools what we have to do the first 2 years in college, and that's teach the grammar of music.
Mm-hmm.
So students understand how they're using those materials to then be expressive. So we have about two steps we have to cover, and I'm going to hopefully try to talk about that Friday. But if you know the gesture, and if you know the context of the gesture, then you can get it. If you don't, like I said yesterday, I had to listen for a whole year to get it,
mm-hmm.
finally get it.
I think this goes beyond art that is specifically a political or social critique. I think the whole function of teaching us to see differently or to hear differently, even as
observers or listeners is potentially revolutionary. And if we are creating art ourselves, that whole process of shifting the boundaries and taking seriously what rises up within us, all of those things can be destructive to obedience and order.
Yeah, because even viewing, one can become less satisfied, or you become dissatisfied with letting things go on incomplete, unwhole, because you know that there are alternatives.
Yeah.
And that, in that sense, if art can be a call to action. I mean, that's Walter Storff, that's actually one of his big points in the book, is that art is continually calling us to act. It's not something that you just sit and contemplate, but that it continually asks us to move out and to act. So that dissatisfaction with what is incomplete, unwhole. Yeah.
And that humorous thing you read in the beginning about the cathedral and the musical thing, I had the thought, in art, it's not humorous, it's almost going that way, isn't it, with the computer?
Yeah, yeah.
And how are you going to meet that with your two boys?
And very carefully,
Well, I think that once, the harp stood up and a person plucked it, and then we got the design of a keyboard with hammers to hit the thing. Because if you look at a grand piano, it looks just like a harp design, flat. And we've always turned to technology. I don't think we need to be upset with technology because it gives us more possibilities to be more expressive. And we will always go back to the old. The harpsichord makers all shut down in the late 1700s because the piano got popular. But suddenly, 100 years later, we want to go back and play the music meant for harpsichord. And I think people will always want to paint. They're always going to want to get their hands on the clay. And I'm always going to play a brass instrument in spite of the fact that my wife has a keyboard and I can go over and play all the synthesized sounds.
The question that you raised, though, is how do you respond to that? Reminded me of this article that I brought along from the February issue of The Lutheran. It was Walt Wangren's column. And I'm not going to take the time to read the whole thing to you, but what happens is Walt Wangren, who has been up here on staff a number of times, on teaching staff, wrote a story called Rag Man, and he was approached by a movie producer who wanted to turn it into a movie, and have people read this? Do you remember the article? And he made, the producer made an offer, can I buy the rights to the story, and he doesn't mention numbers, but it obviously was very low, and Wangren countered with something high, and they moved a little bit, and suddenly the movie producer said, well, I'm just going to stop here because I really don't even need your permission, because what's happened is your story has moved out into the public domain because it has been used in so many different forms. Churches have read the story and turned it into little musicals and have adapted it. And through all those adaptations, your name has not been associated with it, and therefore, legally, it has become part of public domain. So I can make this movie. I didn't have to offer to give you anything. And so for the rest of the article, apparently, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but apparently this is right. And Wangren goes on to talk about how the churches need to stand up and support their artists. I'll just read a little bit. Throughout Christendom, the awakening is slow, and it is the younger artist who suffers most, one who is unable or unwilling to demand recognition, one who may be unaware that she can promote her personal talent without compromising her faith and love for Jesus. The young artist, the tender one, whose income is not yet assured, whose spirit is shy, who doubts her value, especially if she must struggle to be noticed. This was my own condition when I spoke with the movie producer about Ragman. Everything was thrown into doubt. The doubt, that same doubt from Asher Lev. I mean, artists are fragile. They're bold, but they're also fragile. Everything was thrown into doubt. My faith, my artistry, my real motives, and my family's survival. But the church, which can by blithe ignorance render its artists anonymous, might also by public honor persuade them to higher excellence, and so enrich the entire world. Ecclesiastical patronage is a tradition as old as Moses and Bezalel, the story we read earlier, yeah. Congregations, let us identify those among us who seek to make a living by their art, promote them, foster their education, support them by genuine assignments, and then by payment that values what they do. Which artists, writers, yes, poets and playwrights and songwriters, composers whose songs fly free of them, painters, sculptors, weavers, choreographers, woodworkers, those who create material and those who perform it, musicians, dancers, singers, actors. Surely we should acknowledge by name those who enrich our experience of the Christian life. Even so do we name the cooler teachers of the intellect, theologians. Those who plant the vineyard should eat and drink of its fruit, and God commands us never to muzzle the ox that treads the grain to make it fine, fine, fine.
Sounds good.
No argument here.
Yeah. Tomorrow, then, we will move into an area of how you use the arts, how the arts can be forms of expression for you as you worship. And we're going to get a lot probably of dealing with something that David has just mentioned, and that is the commercialization of the arts. Mm-hmm. You see, the gatekeeper moved in on Wangerin, and a lot of what we get, especially our young people, is controlled by the gatekeepers, the people that make money out of this. And I'm not sure that David, maybe David does, but I'm not sure I have all the answers on how we deal with that. I mentioned the Institute for Youth Study at Calvin College and the book that they've published, Dancing in the Dark, as some way to get a hold of it. But there's a lot going on that is a little difficult to control. But I'll bring some music, some cassettes, and we'll respond to them and then talk about how we worship, and especially dealing with the Trinity.
10:30 tomorrow morning.
10:30 tomorrow morning, right after the break.
Thank you.